As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal.
So 50 basis points is the hike from the Bank of England. Standing by, Jordan Rochester, G10 FX strategist over at Nomura. Jordan, your reaction to this decision by the BOE?
Well, John, it's the simple case that this wasn't a big surprise from the Bank of England. We were expecting around 50 basis points. That's what we got today. Conversations with clients as well. 50 basis points from the Bank of England is probably the last 50 basis points from them. It's the first and the last since they became independents, probably. As for us, the view is that the situation in the energy market will decimate the incomes of UK workers. The consumer confidence is going to continue to fall. Consumption is going to continue to slow. And the Bank of England is going to potentially revise down their inflation forecasts. So the last rate hike of this cycle is probably going to be November, is the view from us. And that means it's very unclear to me why today the Bank of England doing 50 is a reason to buy the pound. Now, if they did 75, you would have seen sterling head higher. But, John, the problem for markets is we're just not used to trading 1970s-style stagflation. Yeah. Tom was mentioning there the 13% inflation, really decimating people's ability to spend. The Bank of England will reflect on this. They've already put in their forecast. Today we saw they think the price cap goes up to 3,500 in October. That's about right. It's going up again in January to £3,800 per year for the average household. This is a massive amount of money coming out of the system just spent on energy.
Jordan, I think very much different than the Fed, where we have all the different Fed presidents, including Kansas City, where we'll visit at Jackson Hole. We perceive the Bank of England as the city and maybe London as well. What does 13% inflation do to the Bank of England's relationship with to go to the Premier League this weekend to Liverpool, to Leicester, to Newcastle? What is the BOE relationship with the inflation the North will face?
Well, indeed, you mentioned, Tom, we haven't ventured past Harrods. So one day me and John will have to take to our hometown, north of Birmingham and Sutton Coldfield. It will be felt a lot in the North. We're seeing lots of strikes being held around the UK. I was listening to one of the NHS union representatives just earlier this week, and the pay rises they're being offered after inflation adjusted, roughly 10% real pay cut. It's essentially like asking workers to do a whole month of the year working for free or losing all of their statutory holidays. So the impact will be we're going to have more labour market strikes. This will potentially see wages go up. So it puts the Bank of England in a really strange place that they're raising rates. The consumer is being squeezed. That does lower their inflation forecast perhaps ahead. But if we do get a wage price spiral, this is very 1970s-like. So they're going to be keeping an eye on that. And the way the Bank of England looks at it in the North, they use the Bank of England agent summary. We've only just got it now. So I'll need to look for those details. It came out at the same time as this meeting. But they do get a holistic picture of the rest of the country through the agents. And they will be seeing this story that I've just laid out playing out around the country.
Jordan, I want to dig a little deeper into your idea that November will be the last rate hike. It will be the end to the rate hiking cycle of the Bank of England, raising questions about the front loading of monetary policy and monetary tightening that has been a big discussion. We have the Bank of England warning of a long recession. At what point does that pause in rate hikes lead to rate cuts, in your view?
It could happen quite quickly. The Bank of England was one of the first major central banks to raise rates. They started in December last year whilst everyone was still talking about transitory and Omicron. So when the Bank of England kicked things off in December last year, it gives them the sort of the ability to end their rate hiking cycle earlier than most and also introduce the idea of cuts. So we're looking for May cuts from the Bank of England, that sort of timing. And why? So inflation will still be higher than 2%. I actually think the risk reward is inflation doesn't fall down to 2% as quickly as the market's pricing, but the central banks will react to the situation in credit markets. If you look at the crossover spreads, if you look at the ECB systemic risk, whatever you want to look at, the credit stress in the market is roughly around the same levels as the worst moments in the coronavirus panic of March 2020. I suspect the energy prices, 10 times higher than they were on average in Germany, will knock out the business models of many manufacturers. We're going to see credit stress lead to higher defaults, lead to unemployment rising. And that's why in Q4 and Q1, the story will change for central banks. Even though we'll have high inflation, there could be a dovish moment.
Jordan, South Sterling, still the trade for you?
Indeed. I think we've had a big move higher up to the 122 level. Not very fun for me holding a short for about that period, but the trend is lower in Sterling. It has the same problems as Europe when it comes to this energy crisis. Its bank, central bank, has just done 50 basis points. Look back to the ECB meeting. They did 50 basis points. What did the euro do? Nothing. So just because central banks are doing these big rate hikes, it's not enough to defend their currency against what's a big terms of trade shock. The pound should essentially be trading towards 115 down to 110 just based on terms of trade alone. The price of the UK's exports have fallen, whilst the price of the UK's imports have skyrocketed. The UK needs a weaker currency to help its exchange rate.
Ugly. Jordan, just quickly, can you imagine if the Fed forecast a recession like this one that starts in 4Q and runs through the whole of next year?
Good point.
Could you see them ever
doing
that, Jordan?
That's exactly what we're forecasting.
Could you imagine?
What we're forecasting at Nomura, so I can see it happening, but they'll be a bit slower than us to get there.
Let's get right to it. Our conversation of the day on the United Kingdom with David Blanchflower, professor of economics at Dartmouth College. He darkened the door at the Bank of England a number of years ago. We're thrilled he could join us today. Danny, you've gone through the details and you make it very clear that a la 1947 in a path to the Eisenhower deflation, the inflation panic is overwrought. This is a bank signaling a deflation or a substantial disinflation out to 2024. What should be policy if we model a future disinflation?
Well, obviously, the story is the forecast of a recession. Six quarters of negative growth they're forecasting. But if you go to their, I think it's their chart 1.4, and what you see there is that there's a significant risk in 2024 of deflation. And there's the famous chart the Bank of England produces, shows you 800 years of inflation. And the one thing that stands out from it is the big risk when you have high inflation is that you generate deflation. And so that's obviously the worry. I mean, the truth is, John is right. They're forecasting 13% inflation pretty soon this year. But by 2024, this thing plummets. And I think the likelihood is actually that this forecast is overly optimistic. I think the chances are the unemployment rate is going to rise by much more. Output is probably, I mean, it may not last for six quarters, but output probably is going to be weaker. And we're probably going to see the bank having to U-turn pretty fast. I mean, this is a devastating, terrible forecast. I'm sorry, last point. I remember in 2008 in August, so, you know, a number of reports ago, and the big deal then was the UK was in recession and they didn't use the word recession. The word recession is all over this report. So this is devastating. But I think the argument that balance of risks is balanced, Lisa just talked about it, risks are actually very strongly to the downside to this. So why they actually raise rates, sort of unclear when you read the thing.
Well, Danny, let's talk about how original this moment truly is. And can you imagine the Federal Reserve forecasting a recession in the way that the Bank of England has done today? And why do you think that's the case?
Well, I think in some ways they're under huge political pressure to try and deal with the interest rate, with the inflation rate story. I mean, Truss came out this morning and said the bank should have raised rates earlier and we're going to relook at the remit. So I think the politics of it are pretty interesting. I mean, the fact that the word recession is in this report, I don't know of any other monetary policy report that has that word. As I said, go back to the August 2008, they didn't even use the word recession when they were in recession. So obviously some of the question is, you know, how quickly does recession come and how quickly does the bad data come? But we've got bad PMIs this morning, sales of UK cars down 11%. I mean, this baby could get bad pretty quickly. And I think, as you say, the likelihood of the Fed doing this is is really pretty different. But I think this is pretty unique for the MPC. I've not seen anything like this in all my time with the Bank of England watching.
When you're talking about the balance of risks and how it's incredibly skewed to the downside, how do you then respond to Jordan Rochester's point about a wage spiral that you're actually starting to see in a very real way, and how this bank gets ahead of that to curtail that, even if it requires some sort of recession or significant downside in the near term?
Well, we've been talking about non-existent wage spiral since 2008, which we haven't seen. I mean, we've seen some attempt to try and keep up nominal wage growth. We've seen big falls in real wages. I think the idea of a wage price spiral in the United States and in the UK is for the birds. I mean, we're seeing settlements around 4%. We're seeing public sector workers saying, you know, we need to try and maintain our living standards. The chance that any of this is driven by workers demanding and getting higher wage increases, I see absolutely none of that. None of it in the United States, none of it in Europe, none of it in the UK. We're talking about 13% inflation and workers asking for 4% pay raises. This is not driven, none of this is driven by wages. So I think that whole argument is just nonsense.
Danny, a lot of people are saying that right now this is the Bank of England front-loading rate hikes, that they're going to start cutting rates or at least pausing the rate hikes later this year, then cutting next year. And that seems to be this belief with the Fed as well, that yes, there are some pretty significant rate hikes, but it is a front-loading to try to get ahead of the inflationary push. Why do you think that's a bad idea, to see what you can do now and then wait and then see how it how it trickles out?
Lisa, that's a great point. But I mean, I always had the view that you say what we need to do is get rates up to try and cut them later from the recession that you've caused. So obviously that seems like a problem. I mean, the bigger issue in some sense, Lisa, is that, yes, you've now got rates up. You know, we're talking globally around 2 or something, less in the euro area. The problem actually is, think back to 2008, we could cut from 5% to a half or zero. The room for the central bank to cut is limited. It's going to fall on fiscal authorities. Look, in the UK, there's basically no prime minister. There's no chancellor of the exchequer. People are talking about the plans that they might have, but the pressure is going to come on a new chancellor and a new prime minister pretty darn quickly. And the markets are going to speak, and they're going to say whether they think this is appropriate or not. I mean, we don't even know who the chancellor would be in September when these bad data come in. So I agree with you, but it looks to me that you front load interest rate rises for the recession that you worsen by doing it. So I think there was a significant argument today to actually sit pat and wait, because it's unclear that these rate rises are going to do anything to bring inflation down, being caused by global oil prices. How is these interest rates actually going to do anything other than tank the economy? How do they actually bring prices down? And Bailey's already admitted that basically it can't. So I think there was a strong argument to sit, wait and watch. But the political argument was a very strong one, because the trust was threatening the remit of the banks and they should have raised rates earlier.
Well, I'm not surprised you said that at the end there, Danny. That's for sure. Danny Blanchflower. Danny, always good to catch up.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/GreenFestival.
What we've got here is earnings, but nobody cares, because when you do a transaction of this import and symbolism to Wall Street and, frankly, a recovering world from the pandemic, it is good to talk to Jim Zelter. He's co-president of Apollo Asset Management. And, yeah, on earnings, but I'm going to go beyond earnings, Jim, to your new transaction acquiring the leasing efforts of the largest fleet of 747s in the world. This is the cargo business mostly of Atlas Air. How do you dive into such a troubled industry as COVID, Asia, moving cargo, and say the opportunity is now?
Well, good morning. Thanks for having me on. You know, that's a classic Apollo transaction. We know the industry well. We've been around it for decades. We've successfully navigated it, no pun intended, in terms of a variety of other investments in the space. And it's a classic opportunity for us to use our great industry skills, our great capital formation skills, and do something we think has got a lot of fundamental value where purchase price matters. So, you know, a lot to talk about Apollo today. That's one transaction. But very, very happy with what we've done in that situation.
Well, let's talk about the inflows. $36 billion, I think $13 billion after quarter end in a first close of your next flagship PE fund. Just going through some of these numbers. Jim, as you look at the opportunities in front of you, where are they? What can you do that the banks can't do that you're excited about?
Well, listen, as you said, Jonathan, it's a very foggy environment out there. A lot of dispersion on views on where rates and other things are going. And that's when we do well. You know, record FRE for us for the quarter, record SRE, you know, capital formation, deployment origination strong. You know, for us, it was a great quarter in terms of, you know, investor dialogue. As you said, $36 billion in the quarter. We closed $13 billion on our new flagship Fund 10. And for us, you know, this is the kind of markets that we thrive. When others are a bit paralyzed or markets are closed, we bring our flexible capital, our permanent capital, our ingenuity to transactions. And, you know, I know you mentioned the Atlas Air, but for us, New Fortress Energy was a great transaction. Air France, you know, in New Fortress Energy, basically, we've been with this company for a couple of years. We've been a financing partner. They put their liquid LNG products or vehicles in JV. We provided the equity, but the bank market was shut. Typically, most folks would have to put their pencil down.
Yeah.
We really marshaled our resources and raised $1 billion for financing to have a successful transaction. So for us, these are the markets we thrive. You know, firm is doing extraordinary and hitting on all cylinders.
Jim, you said that the markets are closed, and they were for the most part until last month, where they reopened with a vengeance, and you saw everybody flood back to the market, money pile into even the most speculative debt, people basically sounding the all clear sign. What do you make of that, and how do you sort of adjust your view than perhaps in May when you said that recession was 1/3 to 2/3 of your base case, and you were talking about not taking that duration or liquidity risk?
Yeah, I think you got to differentiate between a rally in credit and the markets being open. The reality is, it's been well publicized that you know, a lot of financing commitments have been hung, if you will, nowhere near what they were in 08, probably $80 billion plus or minus versus the $400 to $500 billion. But new financing commitments are very challenging to secure today. We're a leader in private credit. We extend credit. We borrow in those markets as well. But the reality is the markets, the IG markets open. But the lower quality, high yield markets, still very few transactions are getting done. Very few new commitments are being made on buyouts. So it's not as clear as you said. Again, please don't differentiate a rally in credit versus really an open, thriving financing market.
Jim, can I ask you what you think of that rally in credit, though? 140 basis points of spread tightening on high yield in the last month alone. We've got guests lining up calling that wishful thinking. What do you call it?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. We typically, when spreads go to 600, we usually, that's a buy signal for us historically. They were there for just a couple of a short period of time. As you said, they've rallied dramatically. It feels like the rally, you know, I would say they're on the richer side of fair value than they are the attractive side of fair value. But I think it's interesting to contrast that to the private markets right now. You can, you know, a year ago, high yield indexes were in the mid fours, maybe touching five. You can issue be part of a senior club in private credit right now with spreads, you know, SOFR plus 650, which is basically almost touching 9.5-10%. High quality first lien position, top of the capital structure, 30-40 LTV. So that's an interesting marketplace. And we're open. We've been active at Apollo and at MidCap. The generic on the run high yield market, not particularly interesting. And I suspect you're right. You know, Lisa mentioned I was of the view that, you know, a recession was in the cards in 23.
Yeah.
We still believe it will be. I don't think it's going to be a deep historical a recession. As we all know, the numbers right now, you're having, you know, negative GDP numbers with 400,000 new employment per month. So it's not your father's recession by any means. It's a different kind of environment. But, you know, from our perspective, if you have the ability to navigate, it is quite interesting as many are on pause.
Jim, I've got 20 seconds to squeeze this in. This is the question where the person behind your camera starts waving their hand saying, don't answer it. You were considering helping Elon Musk finance that Twitter bid, given how it's fallen apart. Has that left a bit of taste in your mouth around doing business with him potentially in the future? Just a yes or no, your thoughts on it?
We're a big player in the global financing markets. We finance lots of folks. We're very thoughtful about what we do. And we got a long-term track record to prove that out.
We begin our jobs coverage now. We do it with our great Michael McKee, and then we move to Thomas Porcelli. Tom Porcelli is chief U.S. economist at RBC Capital Markets and first came to my attention with absolutely brilliant study of the wage dynamics of the United States of America. Tom Porcelli, good morning. I want to talk to you about what we just heard from Professor Blanchflower at Dartmouth, where he said basically a linkage of these tumultuous times into wage growth is unfounded. Give us your update on America's wage growth in this 9% inflation we're facing.
I completely agree with his assessment. I think the people that are comparing today to the 70s/80s, I think that they're doing us a disservice. I think that this probably has much more in common with the 40s than it does the 70s. I don't think that this is some wage price spiral that the Fed is trying to or can impact. I think that that effort will bear very little fruit. I think the Fed is hiking pretty aggressively into an economy that's very clearly slowing down. I don't know how that ends well. I think, you know, if their thought process is, well, we got to really tamp down on wage pressures, I don't know how much more you want to tamp down on those. I mean, in real terms, they're deeply in negative territory. I mean, I always like sort of marvel at the idea that I think very few people appreciate that disposable personal income, nominally, in nominal terms, from the beginning of the year to today, mm-hmm. is really up only modestly, nominal.
Okay,
but in real terms, you're deeply in negative. So that whole idea, I think, is sort of foolish. And I would say one last thing, Tom, and then I'll stop. You know, this idea, Mike McKee was talking about this a moment ago, he's right. The Fed keeps on sort of, you know, hanging their hat on the idea that there's, you know, people can find a job really quick and et cetera. And make no mistake, in certain industries, that is still true. But job openings are not the thing we're supposed to be hanging our hat on. It's a massive lagging indicator. They fall in earnest in the midst of a recession. In other words, they're a free option for companies. And we're already seeing them slow now in a more meaningful way. So, you know, this idea, and by the way, sorry, one last thing on that. This idea too that there's, you know, two job openings for every person unemployed, that is not correct. You have to look at people also that are not in the labor force that want a job, right? A completely separate metric. And when you add that to the number of unemployed, what you actually see is that the ratio is actually 1-for-1. And actually, just to be clear, it was 1-for-1 prior to the most recent job openings number. Now it's less than that. So I have no sympathy for that view in any way.
So, Tom, translate that picture into what we're expecting tomorrow with the jobs report that we get out there and the anecdotal data that we're getting from a number of companies that they are starting to cut back workers.
Yeah, Lisa, I think that's exactly right. I mean, you know, again, I know you guys were talking about jobless claims, what number starts to scare you. I don't know why you're not scared now. I mean, you don't have to wait for some magical 280 or 300. I mean, you're up from 166,000, right? That was the low that we hit in mid-March. Well, and so from that point to today, we're now up 50%. Well, now, I know the standard retort on that is, hey, you know, but we're coming off of really low levels. Okay, you were coming off of really low levels in 01, too. I mean, they were historically low then, but hey, we managed to actually lose jobs and the unemployment rate wound up rising. So the level thing is not compelling. It's the move, right? It's the delta. And the delta is incredibly compelling. You're up 50% from the low. And sorry, just to be clear on that. So if you look back to every recession, we went back to the recession that started in 1969. If you look at every recession, from the low into that recession, you're up about 30%. Here we are up 50%. And yes, I know there's some seasonal thing. I get all that. But even if you adjust for that, you're still up wildly. I mean, not a good outcome.
A lot of people would argue that you're coming from a point where everybody had been taken out of the workforce and then brought back in this sort of artificial breach as a result of the pandemic and the global economy shutting down. As we look forward, is your argument that the Fed should look through this and stand pat, not raise rates that much or at all, and sort of wait to see what happens, even in the face of 9.1% headline CPI?
I have a lot of sympathy for lifting rates. I think, you know, look, and you all have heard me say this before. I mean, I think the Fed was very, very late to this. I mean, I would argue that today we should be 100 basis points higher because the Fed was much more aggressive, you know, sort of late last year. But I do have a lot of sympathy for that. I just think that we have to be careful and ask aloud, do you think that these interest rate hikes are actually going to scale back on inflation? I think inflation is going to slow organically. I know that's a tough pill to swallow for the Fed, and I know they can't stand idly by and wait for that to happen. So they have to keep on raising rates. I just think we have to be careful about the level of rates that we get to. I don't know that we have to get wildly into restrictive territory. I mean, look, let's be clear. You know, prior to things starting to turn pretty squishy over the last few months, the backdrop did not need any accommodation. I mean, we should have been at neutral a while ago. But I think now we're in so many ways, I feel like we're fighting yesterday's war on inflation. And moreover, I would add, there's certain components of inflation that have been doing some pretty heavy lifting that the Fed has zero ability to control, whether that's food or energy, things that are obviously now receding to some extent. But I think about some of the inflation components over the last month or two, like auto insurance or car repair. I know that might sound like these small little things. They added like a tenth. Right, they added a tenth or more to the headline to the month-on-month gain. That's an enormous number that, again, the Fed has no ability to control. People went out and bought a bunch of used cars. They are breaking down and they need more insurance. I mean, what can the Fed do about that? So I just think the Fed has to be honest about the things that it can and cannot control.
Tom, I want to finish out with this.
Yeah.
The Federal Reserve and where Fed funds peaks. Where does it peak for the team over at RBC?
Yeah, so we think you get to the midpoint would be 3.375. So basically, they hike over the balance of this year. We think that's reasonable still at this point. I know it's probably sort of in line with what the market is saying. I don't know if I like that or not, but that's where we are right now.
Hey, Tom, it's awesome to catch up. Thank you, sir. Tom Porcelli of RBC Capital Markets.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority. By providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
The signal from our antenna reached to Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, Lewisburg, PA. And long ago, she used to listen to the garbage we do every morning.
I know.
Our fault.
Our
Shanali
fault that
Bassick
she's here.
Yep,
I know.
You were at Scenic Bucknell in school, and you actually were listening to Bloomberg Radio?
I was actually watching Bloomberg TV when I woke up in the morning because I couldn't read financial media. I didn't understand economics. So you used to watch
Bloomberg TV?
I did. Yeah. And so that's I learned sad. A thing or two. Hopefully I'm not disappointing you now.
And so it's our fault. Yeah. Folks, it's our fault. Yep. Shanali Bassick here, of course, looking at all of our banking work. It truly has a wonderful pulse on this island of Manhattan. For all of you worldwide, how nervous is it? What's the sweat factor this first week of August?
I don't think people realize how deep some of the cuts can start to get. Because on one hand, yes, of course bonuses are going to be down this year in many, many businesses. So many businesses have stalled very dramatically. IPOs, SPACs. Remember, SPAC bankers were being hired left and right last year. Even debt underwriting has dramatically slowed down. And M&A has also slowed down. So, of course, bonuses will be down. But the question now becomes job cuts, because you have a lot of banks like Credit Suisse that are in enormous amount of pressure. And they, you know, our scoop this morning from Bloomberg was that they're discussing thousands of job cuts globally.
But are you equating the challenges of American Wall Street with the huge realities of Zurich?
Yes, because Credit Suisse is a huge U.S. bank as well. And not in wealth management, but yes, in investment banking. They were top 10.
So I can get a seat at 11 finally down there at the back end of Madison Avenue?
Listen, the interesting thing about this too is every conversation we have on background with executives is, yes, that normal attrition will probably come back at the end of the year. That 5% culling that usually happens.
Yeah, normal, 4% or 5%.
The question this year is that 4% or 5% become 8-10%. That's a possibility if things continue to go south for the rest of the year. And it's a reality that, remember, there's playing offense and there's playing defense. And if you're an investment bank, you're going to want to play offense, and you're going to want to prepare for a tough time as well. Remember, a good example of this is Morgan Stanley. Remember, a couple years ago, they started cutting jobs before things got bad so that they would have capital to deploy into markets, so that they would have the ability to hire in other areas if they needed to. People like to get prepared.
Shanali, you were just in here in our Bloomberg Interactive studio, I'm going to say 9 months ago, 12 months ago, reporting about how these investment banks couldn't hire enough people, how they couldn't pay their junior people enough, raising their pay three or four times in the course of a year, which I've never seen before. Now it's the exact opposite. I mean, it just kind of confirms my belief, having worked on Wall Street for 25 years, it may be one of the worst managed businesses around.
I don't know that it's worst managed. I think you have to prepare on Wall Street for it to be a volatile business.
Okay.
Right? Tell me if I'm wrong there, Paul.
Are you lecturing Mr. Sweeney?
Yeah, I'll take it. I need some help here. Because
he's been a media star for a while
My whole career was just managing the bonus expectations, which, Tom, you're right. They started in when you got back from Labor Day. Every conversation you had around the water cooler was about bonus pool.
Yeah, bonus out to February, and I'm just suggesting this year it's going to start in. Well, let's go to what Paul was talking about, which is the junior bankers, and we say good morning to all of them. They're studying for CFA Level 4 right now, no question about it. To review, mortals used to get 80 and then they went to 100, and then there was a salary war. Am I right?
Yes. And it's so funny. This is kind of like an insider baseball-y thing going
well,
on now.
It's Bloomberg surveillance.
So it's Bloomberg. We can get insider baseball. Yeah. It's funny because last year, Liquidity, a meme company, had started to break a lot of that news about the junior banker salaries. They themselves hired somebody. So there are two employees for this company. That employee now split off on his own. You're still seeing young people split off on their own. A lot of realities about not only the pay not being what they would have liked, but also the perks being taken away post-pandemic. And now when I speak to young people on Wall Street, not only are they complaining about the perks and the ability not to just kind of leave and join a meme stock company, they also are complaining about the fact that they might need to choose a new career because the hiring classes from, you know, analysts are not being promoted as quickly. Interns are not being hired as often.
Already. Because, Paul, what Shanali doesn't understand is the perks when you and I started was if there were 10 pizzas, you could get a piece of pepperoni and
exactly.
was the perk.
Exactly. The pizzas came in around 8 o'clock at night.
But think about the anchoring here. People were in the pandemic and getting free lunch and dinner. And if they came in, and now they are not. They were getting their Ubers paid for. Now they are not. And so there's a lot of frustration.
So what's the feeling as to, I mean, now we've kind of got the markets rallying here over the last, you know, month and a half or so. I'm wondering what the rhetoric is going to be from some of these Wall Street executives when they do speak, whether it's at a conference coming up here in the fall or some earnings. I mean, how dour can they be? We've kind of got the markets rallying off of this bottom here.
Yeah, I sound like a total permabear. However, you know, Credit Suisse has...
It's called the House of Abramowitz.
Yes.
Someone's got to do it. And if you look at Credit Suisse, it's 51,000 employees. If they cut thousands of employees and get to what, 49,000? They still have... These are very large banks. And so the question is, what kind of cuts are we really looking at? These executives are not going
to
be...
51 to 49,000 is normal attrition. They got to go way past that.
Yeah, I think...
And
they
probably will.
You could argue that, I mean, what we've seen, it seems like over the last decade plus, is that the big U.S. banks get stronger.
Use Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank as an example.
Right, exactly.
They're 20,000.
I got to get this in because Shanali's so up to speed on everything going on. We talked to Mr. Zelter today at Apollo. And they have done a transaction to acquire with a team one of the most romantic companies in the world, Atlas Cargo. Atlas is the largest owner of the miracle, other than the space program of my life, the Boeing 747.
Yeah.
Paul and I watch Cathay Pacific come in from Anchorage to JFK, you know, on our iPhones and all that. But that's an example, Shanali, of how private enterprise is falling into what used to be normal big company
finance.
Thank
you for bringing it up, too, because private credit markets, you know, if you think about it, over at Carlyle, their AUM, the assets under management, and credit alone, where Apollo is the biggest, doubled in 6 months.
Wow.
So they went from 70 some billion to 140 some billion within 6 months.
Why are they boxing out the big firms from transactions like buying Atlas?
It's so simple. Big banks these days in credit markets, in private equity markets, they are subject to things like Volcker. They are subject to other capital requirements. The Fed has clamped down. And so when the economic environment gets tough, by the way, they have tons of leveraged loans on their books right now in which they're taking, you know, an estimated $1 billion to $2 billion worth of losses. There's still losses.
Is there a brain drain from a given big bank? I'm going to pick on Moynihan Bank of America over to people like Apollo.
Big time. But I have to say, even on the buy side, there is some pressure. Private equity marks in the second quarter were down. And so
Wait, that was massive jargon. What's a private equity mark?
So when you're holding private companies, there's usually magic involved where you say it's privately held. It's not publicly traded. We don't lose money because of that. But that's not true. And now you're seeing that. And you see it, you know, look at the hedge funds. Tiger Global was a huge attractor of talent. Chase Coleman.
See how she does that?
Yep.
Michael Barr walks in and she just she just knows to mention the Detroit Tigers.
Yep.
Like
that. Tiger Global. Oh, Tiger Global.
Oh my!
Okay, they're losing worse than the Detroit Tigers.
50% this year.
Shanali, we got to leave it. Thank you for the brief here. It's a September brief, folks, in early August with Shanali Bassick. This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code Radio20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.